Ever try to get into one of Advertising Week's amazing sessions and suddenly hear that the room is at capacity? Now you can still experience it in real time. Listen to that keynote or panel as a live audio stream in the Advertising Week app, powered by Live365. Advertising Week Radio features sessions, podcast clips, curated music, and more, both during the shows and year-round. Visit aw.live365.com for easy access instructions. Live365, the world's audio.
Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is Jason Keane. Jason is the founder of a company, Creative. They are a really interesting company that's been playing in a space that is really, really important today. I would submit, Jason, that you've been doing it longer than most and sort of recognized where things were going, looking at the importance of purpose in what we're doing. So we're thrilled to have a chance to talk to you today. I love that you are in my favorite place, Brooklyn, and excited to welcome you here to Great Minds. So welcome, Jason.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, Jason, we're going to talk about a company and everything that you're doing. I love the space that you're in. It's near and dear to us. But something very early on jumped out, and that is your time spent early, may have been while you were still a student, in Japan, a place that we've spent a lot of time, very different culture, very, very unique. I would say a little bit too insular in some ways for their own good. But I'd love to talk about that early work as sort of a cultural ambassador way back when, give or take 20 some odd years, and how that experience helped shape you and what you took from it then that is probably still with you in some fashion today.
Yeah. Wow. No one's ever asked me about that before. And you're right. It's about 22 years ago. So I had a great time. I was there for 8 years. I was still in undergrad at business school at the time. I went to Stern undergrad. And they had a relationship with the Tohoku Electric Power Company in northern Japan. Tohoku is kind of a prefecture in the north. It's less frequented by tourists than most of the rest of Japan. Most kind of the cultural things people see are kind of middle of the country and south. So I was definitely, you know, a fish out of water, so to speak, in Sendai, which is the main city in the north. What I was brought there for was a fellowship. It was a cultural exchange, but, you know, they wanted us to really bring what we were learning in business school to and just kind of apply it to their business. So it was this really interesting program. I had kind of my own desk in the human resources department. I had regular meetings with different department heads to understand their business. They toured me around to different electric power companies. I even visited the nuclear power plant that, you know, fast forward 15 years later was the one that melted down during the tsunami. And so what I found as I, you know, there wasn't like a specific research objective. They kind of wanted me to get immersed and then come up with something to present. And so I focused on marketing and communications, and I had just kind of read this book on positioning. It's a bit old school now, but I think it was, I want to say his name was Al Reese or something like that. He was very well known in the world of brand positioning. And everyone at the power company was telling me how they, you know, they were really moving in a sustainable direction. And I just felt like their marketing materials were kind of treating it like, you know, nice to have information as opposed to really integrating it into their brand positioning. And so it's a funny market, electric power. Like, it's not competitive in the typical sense of most markets, but there was a newly deregulated aspect of the market where people could choose which electric power company they wanted to get electricity from. And so I basically presented to them that you have this big opportunity to be the more sustainable option through the northern half of the country for those people. I think it was only deregulated to businesses at the time, for businesses that wanted to get their power from a more sustainable solution, and that they basically had an opportunity to differentiate from the Tokyo Electric Power Company because they were, you know, sort of part of the countryside in general in terms of the region they were in Japan. And then they also had a lot more credentials in terms of advancing sustainable solutions, primarily wind power. And so I did a presentation about that and kind of helped them think about, you know, how to evolve their brand icon, how to, you know, talk about key messages through more of a voice or a lens that, you know, leaned into some sustainability to make people really feel the difference. And especially with things like that, you know, that gets into emotional branding. I think, you know, not to generalize the Japanese culture, but like they tend to be more in the space of maybe rational claims of marketing and not kind of how do you create a positioning that has something emotional embedded in it that's values driven.
So you take that and you end up writing a number of articles published very widely, reported on the Today Show, you know, Reuters, Chicago Tribune, other great newspapers and outlets around the notion of ethical guidelines. You were, again, ahead of that, looking at where we would go, where a company would go. Company didn't exist at that time. Talk about that gravitation and that movement. Seems to be some point of continuity to what you were just talking about in Japan.
Yeah, you do your research. This is great. No one's ever asked me such insightful questions.
We have a crack research team here at Great Minds.
No, you're right. I mean, the kind of the long narrative is I've always been drawn, I guess, to the world of marketing and advertising. I think there's something I like about the power of an image or words to kind of evoke an emotion, but then kind of the smart thinking that goes behind it to really build a personality. Like I've always been sort of fascinated that brands in and of themselves are like people. They live and breathe and have a whole set of, you know, they have a purpose within them of why they exist and what they're there to do. But I also have always been drawn to the world of philosophy, ethics, law to some extent. And there was a while, so I kind of went through a back and forth circuitous path with, I was in the marketing and advertising world, and then I kind of was just a little tired of it. And I decided I wanted to, you know, start from scratch and just prioritize what really spoke to me, where I wanted to pursue. And so I went back to grad school. I knew I was pursuing ethics. That's all I knew. And I was just going to start taking classes while still freelancing on the side in advertising to kind of, you know, pay the bills and everything. And I ended up going down this, I discovered bioethics, which was this fascinating world of challenging questions from a moral, philosophical, legal, policy, clinical, all sorts of points of view of basically where technology advances and then therefore makes certain presumptions, whether they're moral philosophy or laws or whatever, it puts them in question. And so you're constantly having to kind of create this debate of what's the right thing to do, what's the helpful thing to do, and looking ahead into the future about technology. And so I kind of dove headfirst into that. And as I got into it, I realized I should probably try to keep my background in marketing and understanding the world of marketing and what motivates consumers and everything like that, and see if I can tie them together just for the sake of a career that looks like it makes sense on paper. And that worked out, actually. So I ended up kind of, I did a research fellowship at Columbia, and I was, you know, learned a lot from different kind of qualitative research around various genetic counseling and ethical issues around that. And the advisor I had, who then became the head of the program that I joined to get my master's in bioethics, suggested, you know, there's this really kind of interesting wild west of assisted reproductive technology, and it was commercialized, and like there's some medical guidelines, but it's a self-regulated part of the medical industry. So, you know, there's a lot of people doing questionable things and no one's really checking on them because you're supposed to self-regulate as an industry. And so that's what I chose to put my research around, which was essentially the market for egg donors and kind of all the ethical conundrums that come out of that, whether you think you're buying an expensive egg because you liked that the egg donor played the flute and, you know, went to an Ivy League school, but, you know, there's really no genetic markers for any of those sorts of things. So there's kind of this fantasy that you're selling, all the way down to what the egg donors are paid and what kind of risks or undue coercion might be involved when the sums of money are truly high and you're selling your body, essentially. And so really explored all that and published three papers kind of on the fact that there was this proliferating market of commercialized eggs and kind of they weren't following the rules, so to speak, that the American Society of Reproductive Medicine had put forward as the ethical way to do business. And it really is this question of like, you know, are they bound by doctor codes or are they businesses and they're just bound by commercial law? And that was kind of the gray area we explored in the research.
Now, you take that and ultimately, going back now, give or take almost 12 years, create a company and real ambition here. you know, to talk about creating a new human-centric model of capitalism, reshaping business, these are big, high-impact notions. Talk about that genesis. Give us the origin story, if you will, of a company. But these are very lofty goals.
Yeah. So there was a very specific moment in time. You know, I had been doing the research I just described. I found it fascinating, but I kind of found the academic lifestyle a little drab. And I was missing what I enjoyed about the marketing and advertising world, which was the speed, the creativity, the character, the color, kind of this vibrant world that was fast moving and dynamic and exciting. And so I wanted to kind of put, I was kind of like, how do I put those things together? I literally did kind of my own exercise of like positives and negatives of the two different industries and how I can combine my strengths and what I like about each thing and put it together. And I had a couple working ideas. And I remember I was on a trip with my friend and business partner, Greg. We were in Thailand. I was sitting on like a raft of floating sticks on a lake and like deciding this is the direction I wanted to go in. I was reading The Economist the year ahead and kind of they were talking about the movement around socially responsible brands and businesses. And in my prior role at an agency called Yard, I had gotten tons of amazing exposure to lots of different brands and founders. And two of the brands I had worked on there were Method and Shea Moisture. And both of those brands, and also Kenneth Cole, and all of those brands had a purpose and sort of a social impact slash activism slash sustainability element to their brand. And Ruth, who was my boss and mentor at Yard, she's the CEO of Yard, is brilliant. And I had learned a lot from her about what it means to really give a brand purpose and really codify the values a brand stands for, translate that into aspirations. So it has truly this uplifting emotional quality that's presenting a world to the consumer that they want to be a part of and showing the consumer who they can be, not just a mirror to the consumer of who they are. I learned all that from Ruth, and I felt like I could put all those things together. And I really enjoyed style and fashion and design. And I know I sound like I'm throwing a lot of variables in, but this is just kind of everything was going in my head. And it was also the moment where, and sort of my idea had come out of the birth of Whole Foods in a way. I realized that Whole Foods was such an interesting business because they stood for sustainability. And yet when you walked into Whole Foods, my experience, especially in the early days, it's like, this place is beautiful. Everything looks delicious. I want all of these things. And yet in the back of my head, I knew it was all super sustainable. A lot of it was impact driven. If you wanted to pick up the label and read the back about the good that it's doing, you could, but you didn't really have to, because just by crossing the threshold of the store, you knew all of that was already thought about and taken care of. And you could just go be a selfish consumer who wants these things that you want and buy them. And you were kind of doing good with values without having to have the burden of looking at every label and investigating, which is just too much work to put on a consumer for them to still enjoy themselves. And so that I felt like that idea of a retail destination where it was all done for you already and allowed you to shop could be applied to the world of fashion, because this is also when the Rana Plaza factory had collapsed in India or in Bangladesh. And, you know, there was people were starting to really think about H&M and the kind of waste and Zara. That was kind of the conversation at the time. This is sort of maybe 2012-ish. We launched in 2013. And I felt like I could take that growing awareness of the negative side of fashion with the fact that people wanted to do good with their purchases, because you saw brands like Method and Shea Moisture. And, you know, this is when the Red campaign was happening and all these new things were starting to pop up as design-driven ideas for brands that were doing good. And you could kind of take that Whole Foods model and apply it to fashion. So I was taking a lot of inspiration from different pieces. And we were ultimately, I launched it as an online boutique. We were really the first people out there doing it in a big way. We were carrying products from over 300 different designers and brands. And sorry, just to back up, the model was all about uplifting humanity through a design-driven shopping platform. So it was apparel, accessories, home decor, and giftables, all supporting either indigenous artisan communities, fair trade workshops around the world, or nonprofits. So in some way, it had an impact on people's lives. I was very decidedly not including items that were sustainable just from an eco point of view, because I felt as though the emotional connection really comes through when there's human impact. And the idea that, you know, you bought a journal that was made of recycled paper is, you know, it's good, but it just didn't have the gravitas in terms of your own impact and your purchase. I felt like the brands that made you feel like there was another person on the other side of the exchange that was being lifted up by your purchase is where the emotion really came together and made it a more focused experience. And that's actually a philosophy that I still have, in the sense that so many brands are just kind of lumping all things ethical into one group and saying it's like, our brand is doing good. And I think they think that's what purpose marketing is. And I don't think that is what it is. You have to tap into a real emotional through line. And I think things get watered down a lot when you just call it like good or something like that.
So I love this notion that you have of we make good work. And you've now evolved the company. I know along the journey, you launched a company made as a sort of a licensing arm of the company, the creative arm, of course, but you're working with A-list clients now. This thing seems to be working. Take us inside the company laboratory, if you will, and talk about that evolution from an idea that has early roots as we traced, but all of a sudden now you're winning awards, you're playing in there with the big boys and girls, and you're having a real impact.
Yeah. So as I launched the e-commerce business, I was fortunate enough about in like year two, things were working, right? You could start to see what people were responding to. A lot of it became like the nuts and bolts of e-commerce and retail, which is merchandising and customer acquisition. And I don't know that I was fully prepared for some of the heavy lifting on that side. I was coming at it from a vision and a brand point of view, which was definitely working. And I presented at a conference about what we do, and that, you know, you could really create immersive storytelling through these narrative merchandising ideas that, you know, when we were creating stories from all the artisans around the world, you could do a collection all about India, you know, and the beautiful craft and color of India. You could do a collection that's just all about women from around the world. And these are all different, you know, ways that you can empower communities through their cultural craft. You could do a collection that was all about, you know, upcycled plant-based materials, like, you know, earrings made from acai beads from the Amazon and bracelets made from water hyacinth. And like all, so you could basically kind of find these very editorial lenses that became narrative ways to show product. And given me and my team's background, we could easily bring the content to life to make it a compelling marketing story. And so I presented that to a conference, and fortunately, the head of style partnerships was in the at Target was in the audience. And she came up to me at lunch from the conference, and she said, I'm really interested in this. And I said, we could do such amazing collaborations for Target. And a year later, after kind of some, you know, thinking and a few pitch decks and things like that, they chose to do the collaboration with us. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever pulled off, because getting ready for wholesale and like a corporation like Target was a humongous leap. I was still running the business out of my apartment at the time. And so, but we pulled it off. And that really included, it was 45 different SKUs from artists and groups all over the world, or specifically six different countries. And we were able to integrate upfront with the marketing department at Target so that they funded us to go into these countries and shoot content. And so we did both things. We delivered a collection, and we went to India, we went to Kenya, we went to Ecuador and Guatemala, and literally, you know, climbed the mountains and met the artisans in their homes, which in many cases was one room with a bed, a stove, and a loom, you know. And like nothing like that had ever existed before in Target. And we were able to bring it to life through video and through photography. And I'm giving you all this detail because that really was the turning point, because ultimately I had to kind of step away from the e-commerce business. It just became, in the world of Amazon and everything else, like very hard to financially compete. I didn't have investors with me, but I realized, and sorry, also on the side, we had built a nice little business around corporate gifting. We had clients like Unilever, AMC Networks, WeWork, Barclays Bank, who were coming to us and purchasing, you know, little pouches or coffee mugs that were supporting these communities or supporting women. I realized that there's a significant B2B need for what I was doing. And I had kind of created a consumer experience. But if people like Target and Unilever are all coming to me trying to tap into this, maybe that's where the business should go. And so I kind of started changing the dials. I kind of moved away from a focus on e-commerce and realized that I could start selling this idea in a service-based model, much like I had done in the world of advertising and what I knew how to do well. And so I don't remember how exactly it happened, but I got an introduction to Nespresso, and they were interested. They were launching I basically went to Nespresso and I said, you guys have your coffees coming from 30 different countries around the world. We have artisans in all those countries that we know how to work with. Why not try to come up with, you know, a coffee accessories program that supports those communities and becomes like, you know, a beautiful, meaningful message in your consumers' lives that's adjacent to their coffee consumption experience that really shows the impact and the care you have in all those different countries. And we did our first project. They purchased some baskets from us from Tanzania to launch their coffee from Tanzania. It might have actually been Zimbabwe. I don't remember the country. And so they used that as their first influencer gift. And then they asked us to do some content around a new launch that was coming out. And then we got a project to develop some accessories for them with our artisans. And then COVID hit. And interestingly enough, we had three other clients in the works. We had a collaboration. We were basic soft green lighted for Banana Republic. We were working with ABC Carpet and Home. We had just started Nespresso. And when COVID hit, you know, all the marketing budgets went out the window, except for Nespresso, because guess what? Nobody went to Starbucks. They all bought Nespresso machines at home for a year. And so Nespresso, they were able to kind of keep going with us, and they gave us extra projects, and then it grew from there. And frankly, it kind of dawned on me like, okay, I've got a whole agency model on my hands that I wasn't even really planning to start, but suddenly became very obvious. I think I was just always following what was working and what my intuition was telling me to do. But it's not like I was saying to myself, I can't wait to go start an agency. But it presented itself that way. And it suddenly just really made a lot of sense. And so we grew during COVID working with Nespresso. We also got a project with Levi's that was a bit more of a traditional campaign, not super purpose-led at the time, but you know, in the middle of COVID, you take what you can get. That's going to then kind of launched into the Accompany Made side too, which was a whole other story. But that's kind of where the pivot happened. It was really Target realizing the appeal of it and then realizing that there's a B2B opportunity, not just a B2C opportunity.
So let's dive into one example in particular to bring the Accompany value proposition to life. I love what you did around artisans and Jurassic Park. Can we talk about that one?
I had been talking to various people in Hollywood for a couple of years. So we'd actually talked to many different film properties. People jumped around. And then some of the people I'd been talking to jumped to Jurassic, and they had seen some of my thinking, and they asked if there's a way we could apply kind of our sustainability mission-led mindset to Jurassic. What would we come up with? And part of that was because, you know, the sixth film was coming out, and there were themes of sustainability and coexistence kind of baked into the movie. So they felt like there might be a big opportunity. And so we said, absolutely. And, you know, Jurassic is an interesting movie franchise. There's so many underlying themes, you know, everything from like, you know, women in STEM to the beauty and wonder of, you know, nature and genetics and things that have gone extinct or at risk of being extinct. And so We presented to them three different kind of conceptual pathways. And part of what we see as our secret sauce is really, you know, connecting the dots between mission. I call it mission, merchandising, and marketing, like connecting the dots between those three spaces under one idea. And so that's what we showed them, were three different ways to do that. And they picked the one that was really leaning into this preserving legacies of the past, you know, for a new era into the future. And so that one really leaned into the artisan manufacturing side of things. They loved what we had done with Target, and we developed it. And we actually went really broad because we weren't sure what retailer was going to jump on board. It was a new way of looking at it. And it's tricky because you're competing with a lot of the other licensed goods that make money for, you know, the film, but also the licensees. And artisan products are a new kind of space, and they're not always as price competitive. And, you know, you really need to be able to bring the value of them forward in order to make them fly off the shelves. And there's also certain retailers that works in and others that it might not work in. So we looked at a lot of different categories. We finally landed on, you know, themes around basically, you know, you got to really use the IP when you develop product. So making sure we found ways to use the core Jurassic logo, that T-Rex logo, finding other ways to bring in dinosaurs, obviously speaking to kids and families, but you've got those millennial parents that grew up with the movie that they have kind of their own demand for it. And so we came up with a collection that had a kids focused program and then an all family kind of movie night focused program. And we ultimately found an incredible retailer who also helped us with some of the artisan manufacturing. And they're a nonprofit. They're called 10,000 Villages. They've been around since like the 1940s. They practically invented the word fair trade. And, you know, marketing innovation is not really their specialty. And so what we were bringing to them was really exciting because they had never thought about being able to partner with Hollywood or how to go tell, you know, the stories of their artisans through compelling and exciting videos and content, or really being, you know, youthful and exciting with the product design. So we kind of brought all that to the table. They were the perfect partner for us. And we were able to launch it all. It was a challenging project. And it took a lot of figuring out, like, you know, where can what budget come from, what part of the process, because artisan work doesn't fit neatly into existing licensing structures. You know, the licensing business sort of assumes you've got a lot of manufacturing. Like, you know, I've got a lot of licensing. It's like, I've got all these factories that can pump out lots of jeans and t-shirts. All I need is your logo to slap it on. And we were coming at it like, you know, there's artisans all over the world and we can work with all these groups, but it's an operational lift to work with artisans, let alone the operational lift to get the retailer's compliance team through getting comfortable with artisan manufacturing, and then let alone needing to go there and really tell the story and have an investment in the content to get the consumer to understand the value of the goods. So it's thrilling because I really feel like we trailblazed the space. And we are continuing to do so. We have other artisan projects coming out. We have one coming out with Neiman Marcus in 3 months. And yeah, it was hard and continues to be hard because, you know, it's like you need the big companies to sign on for this to really make a difference. And at the same time, the big companies are the hardest ones to get comfortable with this because there's so many players and there's so many processes that aren't set up for artisan work. And I guess my last point is, all, as you hear throughout this, like there's this common narrative of putting product at the center. And that's what I think makes us really different is, and I think that's why we actually just won Purpose-Led Agency of the Year at Ad Age's Small Agency Awards, silver, not gold. But I think a lot of that's because we have product development and mission-led sourcing as part of our offering. And so we're able to come up with programs that aren't just a video, they're not just an outdoor ad or a stunt. They actually develop, which is time-consuming, products that have the meaning and the mission built into it so that you're then creating a narrative around it. But you've got this tangible thing that creates the impact, creates traction in the world of doing good, because otherwise the marketing can't go too much further than promoting conversations or adding a dollar onto your purchase. Like this was really working with communities who had capacities and skills and just supporting them and finding ways to make what they do relevant in the brand's world.
It's a tremendous story. I love what you're doing, Jason. It really,
thank you.
It's the best of us in so many ways. So you're give or take a dozen years in now. There must have been some semblance of a business plan way back when. If we were to look back at the journey, are we on plan, off plan? Was the progress what you'd hope for? I'm going to guess, like most founders, it went in different directions that were unpredictable, and you sort of, you know, walked through some doors where opportunity presented itself that were consistent with your core mission. But there's always a nature of an element of unpredictability of any entrepreneur's journey. Give us a sense as to where we are today, and what do you think the next dozen years might look like?
I don't even know if I should say this or not, you know, publicly, but whatever. There really wasn't a plan. I was pursuing a belief, and that belief is, I'm trying not to, like, you know, I want to change the world for the better place, right? Like there's a big part of me that wants utopia and everyone to be peaceful and happy. And at the same time, I'm not anti-capitalism. And so it's sort of that inherent tension that I was trying to grapple with, right? Like, let's embrace market economics and just try to steer it in the right direction. And to do that, I believe if you can just captivate consumers and have them want the thing that does good, then there's no more questions, right? You don't need to convince a CFO and a CEO to do good if the consumer's asking for it. Guess what? They're going to show up and sell whatever the consumer's asking for. So I just felt like if we could figure out how to take things in the manufacturing process, for example, that really have a truly beautiful emotional benefit by bringing this economic opportunity to these communities that are sitting there saying, like, I can do all this work. I make beautiful things. I just don't know who wants to make it for me. And you can figure out how to have what they do become commercially marketable in markets like the US or around the world where there's a real engine, then that can change the world. It's just embracing what it's all about and funneling all that economic good in the right direction. So it's going to them and not just to like cheap factories that are, you know, all they're doing is optimizing margins and probably ruining the planet and the people that work there. So that was really the guiding belief. And I think, to be honest, there were years of just changing the business model and over because to see what was working, because, you know, my background in the agency world is business development. So I know that I know how hard it is to get a new client and get yourself out there and get the contract. And so I was really pursuing like where I could sense there was true interest in doing these types of projects. So that was Target, that was Nespresso, that was Hollywood, because I met some people and I was saying, you know, it actually started before Jurassic. It started with a conversation with Avatar and some of the people that were working on Avatar. And that's what got people interested. And that's what got people to really, and then I spoke to National Geographic, and that's what really just kind of got me meeting lots of different people in Hollywood. It ended up being that Jurassic was the first one to come to light. And so I would say now, looking back, you know, I tried a bunch of things. It was a windy road to get here. So I think moving forward, there's certainly more of a business plan, at least in my mind. And I think that is to work with a range of clients on an agency model basis. In other words, they pay for our time or there's some kind of revenue share built into it, but I'm not necessarily spending all of my resources to show them what their business could be. We need to be paid more like consultants up front because it's not sustainable otherwise. But in a lot of different industries. And so the way I kind of, and so that as an agency, we are always working on projects that have some kind of social impact or sustainability aspect or DE&I in some cases built into it, so that we feel like we are not only driving clients' businesses forward across marketing KPIs, but we are also just bringing more good into the world. And so the way I kind of think about working with clients is there's almost three groups. There's the big guys, right? Nespresso/Nestle is a big company. NBC Universal is big. And those big companies have to always have, they're too big to not have a philanthropy, CSR, or sustainability program. They have to. And a lot of those brands were not designed from the beginning to be purpose-led. So they're figuring out how to integrate it into their brand, because they can't say like a Method or a Shea Moisture, for example, that since the beginning they've had a mission. They just can't say that usually. So they have to figure out how to have some sort of platform or regular drumbeat about here's the good that we're doing to positively impact you. Then there's the type of clients that are more mid-sized, and those are brands that have had a sustainability or mission focus since their inception. So we're working right now with Vestiaire Collective. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're kind of like the Real Real. They're Europe-based, and we're helping them grow in the US. But that's a business model that in many ways is defined by sustainable principles from the get-go, right? Because it's all about luxury resale. Don't buy new, buy pre-owned, buy pre-loved, so that you're not creating more stuff in the world. And also because of all the, you know, all the sustainability, all the impact on shipping and on on the climate from producing new things in factories. So there's kind of those sets of clients that are more mid-sized, but their brands are purpose-led through and through. So kind of whatever we work on with them would make sense. And then there's nonprofits. And so we really are wanting to work with nonprofits and help them be punchier, bigger, innovative brands. So the YMCA has been a client of ours for several years. We worked a bit with God's Love We Deliver. We're talking to a couple nonprofits now. You know, all of this from an agency business model point of view, it has to kind of mix, because obviously the bigger clients will have healthier budgets. Nonprofits do not have robust budgets. And it's really trying to figure out the right mix so that we can survive and pay the bills we need to pay. But that way, everything is really linked under a sense of there's mission to it. There's a role that this marketing or product innovation is playing in furthering the world that we all want to live in.
Well, it's a great story, Jason, and I can't thank you enough for spending time with us here on Great Minds. You know, when somebody is hitting that sweet spot of doing business and also is in the business of doing good, that's really the best of us. And that's what you're doing at a company. It's a terrific story. And I really enjoyed our conversation today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll keep it going.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.